Hello, so yes, my name's Rena. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Okay, brilliant. So thank you very much for inviting me today. And I promise I'll try to be on time because I know I'm just before lunch. So yes, I work in psychodermatology. So this is a link between psychology and dermatology. And so as I'll talk about within my presentation, the importance of relating these two when for people with skin conditions. So this is just an overview of what I'll be talking about today. And to start off with, I wanted to think about what is vulval pain. I appreciate some of you here may have vulval pain. So just think about in your mind one or two words that you would relate to vulval pain. Anyone want to shout them out? Any more? Stinging, okay, fantastic. So what I'm trying to show is that vulval pain is subjective. So everybody has their different way of feeling pain and different way of talking about pain. So in terms of a definition, we think about it as an unpleasantly sensory and emotional experience. So this is linking the physical aspect with the emotional and psychological experience, and so hence it's very subjective. Importantly, it doesn't correlate with the severity of the condition. And in terms of diagnoses, the important thing is to understand is just dynia just means pain. So whether you have vulvodynia, that's pain of the vulva. And if you have, say, vestibulodynia, that's just pain of that specific area. And so the two main subtypes that the clients that I work with, most of them fall into these two categories in terms of generalized vulvodynia or vestibulodynia. In terms of generalized vulvodynia, it's the pain in different areas, and this can happen at different times. It could be constant, and it's a bit more ad hoc, should we say. Whereas with vestibulodynia, it's pain within one specific area, and it's only after touch. And it's important to recognize that these conditions can coexist. Vulvodynia is further classified by the anatomical site of the pain, and it's whether the pain is provoked or unprovoked. Unfortunately, the prevalence isn't clear. It's approximately 9 to 15% worldwide. However, we feel that this is under-diagnosed because of maybe due to feelings of shame, due to feelings of anxiety, and also inexperience of the clinician. It's seen in mostly Caucasians. However, the big limitation of all the studies that have talked about this is that most of the research is within the USA and within Sweden. And the consequence of having vulval pain is important to think about, that there are physical factors and psychological factors. So moving on to the psychological impact of vulval pain, researchers show that there's high levels of psychological morbidity and psychiatric morbidity within this client group. And one particular study, and this is corroborated by other pieces of research too, that people with vulval pain can show symptoms of, say, obsessive compulsive symptoms or paranoia. So, for example, obsessive compulsive symptoms could be you're constantly checking for certain things or constantly washing because you might be scared of something. Depression in terms of low mood or tearfulness. Anxiety is one of the most significant symptoms that I've seen within my clients. And this could be where you're constantly worrying about getting thrush, for example, or the pain, the fear of pain. And paranoia could be there's unfounded fears of having pain or fear of other people, being paranoid about other people around you. And overall, there's a reduced quality of life. One particular qualitative study, which means that a researcher just interviewed a number of people with vulval pain. So some of the themes that came out of the study said that the women felt had feelings of being an inadequate woman, an inadequate partner. Another theme was positioning the self as a failure for experiencing pain during sexual intercourse. This affected the ability to satisfy partners sexually, and this resulted in feelings of shame, guilt, and a decreased desire for sexual contact. So these themes are nicely encapsulated within one of these quotes, saying, "The impact of vulvodynia has been far greater than physical pain. Over time, my feelings of inadequacy have grown. I felt inadequate as a wife, inadequate as a woman. I began to resent my body and the fact that it was faulty. and feelings of ugliness grew also. So in other pieces of research have shown that people with vulval pain have difficult sexual experiences, and these can have an impact on your relationships in terms of your family relationships, your intimate relationships, and your social relationships, which can have an impact on your self-esteem and your body image. And in time, this can then cause anxiety and depression. Stress and anxiety can also cause vulvodynia and vice versa. It's a bit like the chicken and the egg. There's research to show that stress can exacerbate skin conditions, including vulvodynia, and vice versa. We're not sure which one comes first. And also, the National Institute of Health research have showed that people with vulvodynia have difficulties of engaging in sex, engaging with, unable to have, enjoying their life to a full capacity, which can have a big impact on socialization and work, so your overall quality of life. So moving on to chronic pain. So just a little bit in terms of the difference between chronic versus acute. So chronic pain is where it's long term, and it may not, there may not be an identifiable cause, whereas acute pain is short term and it disappears once the area has healed. There are different types of pain, as we all know, in terms of a sharp pain or a dull pain, and this is because we all have different types of pain receptors within us that transmit different messages at different speeds. And we all feel the pain differently because we all produce different amounts of neurotransmitters. And importantly, chronic pain can cause hypersensitivity and fearfulness, which is something that we're very mindful of within when conducting psychological therapy. So this is just an overview of this theory of psychology of pain. So if you have an event, for example, having sexual intercourse, then that can send messages to the gates in your spinal cord. And there are factors that can open or factors that can close the gate. And according to this, the person then experiences the amount of pain according to the amount of factors that open and close the gates. So we'll talk about this in a bit more detail. So as you can see here, there's a relationship between your spinal cord and your brain, and there's messages that are sent between the two elements. The things that influence what messages that are sent to the gate are messages from all over your body, and the things that influence this are psychological and social factors. So the things that open the gate, that you cause more pain, are things like stress and anxiety, as we've already heard in the other talk. And when you're feeling stressed or anxious, this can cause the gates to open more. Then these send more messages to the brain, and hence you feel pain more so than if you weren't stressed. So for example, an example of this is if you were feeling pain during intercourse, then you may not want to have intercourse again because your memory of that pain. However, in time, this can cause anxiety and maybe a fear of sex rather than fear of pain. And then this can your fear of pain can override you ever having a positive experience again because you're concentrating on the pain. So it's a bit like focusing on the pain versus having an open focus. So things that can open the gates are things like relaxation and activity. This is these prevent the messages from going through to the gates and through to the brain, and so these then reduce the amount of pain that you feel. Okay, so for example, if you are doing a marathon or you are doing some sort of activity that you really enjoyed, by doing this, you'll run through. If you have it, you are feeling pain, then you would run through that the pain because you're enjoying the activity. Your mind is focused on something else. However, if you were home alone, not doing anything and feeling quite bored, for example, then you may focus more in on the pain, which can then increase the amount of pain. There's also a relationship between your energy, your sleep, your mood, and your activity. So, for example, being in pain can drain your energy, which can have an impact on your sleep and your activity. It can sometimes cause you to want to sleep all the time, and then because of this, you don't want to do any activity. Sometimes when you're anxious or low mood, this can inhibit you from wanting to do any activity. And so basically everything affects everything within this cycle. So if within therapy it's looking to try and help with one of the activities in a stepwise fashion to influence on the other things. So in terms of treatment, there's many different types of treatments, as we know, but the important thing is to treat from the outside in. So to treat your skin, your nerves, your muscles, and your mind. So as I said, in terms of psychodermatology, it's treating the skin and the mind together. There's a very strong relationship between your skin and your mind, as we know that the stress exacerbates skin disorders and vice versa. So within treatment, within our clinic, we're very clear to have multimodal treatment, so we're all involved with the clients. It's important to recognize that individuals do respond differently, so don't give up hope. It's a bit of like a trial and error approach, and the progress might be slow. You might find that you'll see progress on a month-by-month basis rather than on a daily basis. One piece of research said that 30% of women, their symptoms do resolve with no treatment, and within this, 50% resolve within 1 year. But I think the main important message is the combination of treatments, of psychological treatments and medical treatments, is more effective than one single treatment alone. So in terms of a multimodal treatment, within our clinic, we have dermatologists and gynecologists who may help with medically in terms of medication, in terms of whether you have an eczema there, and they can help, the medication can help to reduce itch and to reduce the pain via the nerve transmitters. Clinical psychologists, we help with pain management and coping with this, relationship difficulties and mental health difficulties in terms of body image issues, anxiety and depression. There's also psychosexual counsellors that help with sexual rehabilitation, which could help with physical non-coital sexual contact. And physiotherapists and chiropractors can help with physical therapy to help overcome pelvic floor muscle dysfunction. But the important thing is that we all work together. So one of the therapies that I'd like to concentrate on today, there are many different types of therapies, but one in specific is called cognitive behavioral therapy, also known as CBT. There's lots of research to show that this can help people with vulval pain. And research has shown that it helps to control the pain to reduce painful intercourse. And there's also research to show that it is comparable with surgery. This is after a 2-year follow-up. So it's CBT and or surgery can help to reduce the pain during sex. So what is cognitive behavioral therapy? It's looking at the relationship between your thoughts, your behaviours and your feelings. And when I say feelings, I mean your emotional feelings and your physical feelings. So just a quick diagram here. Your emotions are linked to how you're thinking. So if you're feeling lonely or if you're feeling quite sad, this can then trigger negative thoughts such as no one will like me or I'm ugly. This can then cause physical feelings within your body such as having headaches or your heart might be racing. And this then can help maybe you don't want to do anything. You might avoid certain situations. And importantly, all these things interact. So another example of this, a very simple example, is if when you wake up, your thought might be, I'm hungry. Your emotion might be, you might be a bit grumpy. Your physical feeling might, you might have a stomach ache. So what's your behavior? You go and get some food. So this cycle happens to us all the time with every situation that we do every day, all day. So it's a very unconscious process. So within therapy, it's about making us aware of what we're doing and how we can impact on that to make it more of an adaptive way of living. So it's how we respond to the pain is related to how we think about it, how we feel about it, and how we manage it. So if we think about a good day versus a bad day, it's a good day, as I've said, it could be when you're home alone, you're engrossed in activity, you could feel more positive about certain things, and maybe after time, then your pain could reduce. However, a bad day could be you're home alone, you're not engrossed in anything, you're feeling quite lonely, you might be feeling quite frustrated that the pain is taking over your life maybe. By doing that, you're concentrating on the pain, which can then increase the pain. So as I said, focusing on the pain increases the pain, and focusing away from the pain decreases the pain. So one of the cycles that we look at within therapy is looking at negative thoughts, which can have an impact on low self-esteem. As I said, this can have an impact on your anxiety, and then this has an impact on your pain. So it's a self-perpetuating cycle. So we try to break this cycle by thinking about things in a stepwise fashion. So linking the cognitive behavioral therapy with the pain theory was with the physical factors, there are certain things that open and close the gates, which is something that we look at within therapy. So you've got the inappropriate activity level versus medication, which would be helped by the dermatologists. In terms of emotional factors, things that open the gates are tension and worry, whereas to close the gates, you've got relaxation and optimism. And in terms of cognitive behavioral factors, things that open the gate are not doing any activity at all versus concentration on an activity that you're very much engrossed in. So the types of things that we do within cognitive behavioral therapy are goal setting. We're making sure that it's very much an individualized therapy to the particular client or their family or couple. Building the coping skills of the client and increasing appropriate exercise to their ability. And importantly, to introduce relaxation. For people with vestibular allodynia, we also look at doing acceptance through touch. This is a graded exposure type of program to help reduce the pain on touch. And thinking about the negative cycle, we try to break this cycle by building a positive thinking style by looking at different elements within the negative cycle, which we looked at before. So there's research to show that support is one of the most important things when within therapy. So the more support you have, the better it is within therapy to help you cope with different things and to explore things and be reflective outside of therapy as well. And overall, it's about building your self-esteem and your confidence and to be able to cope with your condition. Approximately, the sessions are 1 hour long, and they could range from 6 to 8 sessions. You can find a psychologist within the NHS if you want to, or within the British Psychological Society website. Private treatment varies according to the practitioner, and you can refer via your GP. If you have access within the NHS, that's even better, but I'm not sure how many psychologists there are working in the UK in terms of helping people with vulval pain. The type of techniques that we use are, in terms of behavioural techniques, it would be weekly diaries to build your awareness, enhancing your ability to relax, and also in terms of cognitive elements, it could be to keep a positive diary or to really explore your type of thinking styles. We all think in different ways, so it's exploring that in a more fuller way. An important thing with cognitive behavioural therapy is homework. So every session you'd be given some homework to do, so you'd have some thinking space and to do some thinking time between each session. So one of the main things that have been shown to be helpful with vulval pain is relaxation. So I'd like you to close your eyes, sit comfortably, and I'd like you to breathe in through your nose and breathe out through your mouth. It's the most simplest technique to lower your stress level. So really slowly to breathe in through your nose and to breathe out through your mouth. Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. So by listening to the clock, feeling what's around you, and just concentrating on your breathing, this can help to reduce your stress level. So you can open your eyes. So by doing that, along with the open focus, I guess, is that it's a way of doing the breathing wherever you are, whatever situation you're in, by just concentrating on your breathing can lower your stress level and regulate your breathing. Because when we're anxious or when we're running at a higher level, our concentration is poorer. Everything, we might feel overwhelmed. We're not sure which way to turn. We're not sure what to do. By taking a few seconds just to control your breathing, your thinking space is kind of increase to some effect. And the other types of techniques are things like color breathing, where you breathe in the color red and you breathe out the color blue by doing imagery. And another one is external focusing. So imagine if you're on the tube and you have some sort of pain or vulval pain, then what would you do? So by external focusing, what that means is by concentrating on what's around you. What are the adverts saying? What are people wearing? What are people doing? Trying to focus on something away from you, and by doing the breathing, you'll distract yourself away from the pain. Okay, so I'd like to end with a case study. I have consent from one of my clients with vulvodynia. She had vulvodynia, she referred for me with anxiety and relationship problems. And she's a lady who's aged 42. So within this, we started off by exploring her experiences of pain, her experiences of having therapy, and her experience of her day-to-day life. What are her current coping strategies, and what sort of things that she does to help and to stop her pain? First of all, we helped to raise her self-awareness by we went to the Vulval Pain Society website. She had leaflets. It was about raising her own awareness of what she could learn about herself and learn about her own body, and also about what increases the pain and what decreases the pain. So we had a kind of baseline before we did any therapy. The importance of balance was introduced quite quickly. This was a lady who used to work all the time. She used to come home, used to run around looking after the children. She never had much time for herself at all. And when she was in pain, this was a time when she would, because she became so anxious, she often had to take days off work because she became quite anxious. And when she, sometimes if she was at work, she would have to, her concentration would reduce, which affected her work outcomes. So one of the things we introduced was for her as simple as at 6 o'clock when she got home, she used to sit down with her husband and have a cup of tea. And she had to do that every day for a week and to see how she felt. Thinking about the negative cycle, we looked at this and we tried to think about ways to have a more positive mindset, to see pain as a bigger picture. So if we kind of call it the helicopter view. So if you were standing at the bottom of the hill, what would you see? You'd just see a hill. If you were in a helicopter, what would you see? You'd see the hill, you'd see everything around you. And it's about putting it in perspective in terms of how much, what else is going on around you, and trying to think about other things other than just your pain. And sometimes it's learning just to accept that pain is part of your life, and thinking about the mind-body connection and being really aware of what things make you stressed or anxious, and how to have certain strategies to help you with that. And also how to manage the pain, certain strategies, having a sense of responsibility, having that it's not your sole identity, and learning, as I say, different strategies of how to reduce the pain, and focusing on the positives and focusing on the strengths that you already have. Introducing a healthy lifestyle in terms of, we know the relationship between sleep and your activity and your pain and your mood. So it was about looking at this cycle to help to introduce more sleep, to increase her exercise to her ability, and to have more time with her husband. And also how to manage the stress. Relaxation was one of the things that she found quite useful. And she also then learned to do times of meditation. So every morning she would wake up 15 minutes early just to do 10 minutes of meditation before she went to work, which she found really helpful. And it was also about setting priorities and having realistic goals. So what were her priorities at that period of time? And to set more manageable goals, set more smaller goals that she would be able to meet on a weekly basis, and importantly, to reward herself. So she used to set weekly priorities and weekly goals, and by the end of the month, her reward was to buy a new pair of shoes if she was able to do all the things within therapy which she was successful in. And also she kept a reflective, positive diary, and within this she had ratings of 0 to 10, 10 being bad, of how much she was in pain and how much she enjoyed or did not enjoy an activity, and then writing about all her positive experiences every day. And this helped her to reflect on all the good things that she was doing in the week, including how she used to deal with her pain, and how, and in time, she developed a larger list of strategies to help her with her pain. Importantly, she developed a plan. Research has shown that if you develop a plan, you're more likely to carry it out. For example, saying, I need to go to the gym, rather than saying, I need to go to the gym, having a plan, saying, I'm going to go to the gym on Wednesday at 6 o'clock, you're more likely to carry it out. So for her, what she did was to, she said, at 6 o'clock every day, I'm going to go home and have a cup of tea with my husband. Having that plan, she was more likely to do it, and she reminded her husband that they had that time together, which was very helpful for them. She was in touch with others, with support groups, which helped her to reduce the feeling of isolation, and also helped her partner to meet other people who are in the same situation. My mind's gone blank. What else did she do? I'm trying to think. She reduced her isolation and also helped her to increase her social group. By meeting other people within the support groups, she was able to socialise more, and she was able to share her experiences, which for her was very important. And we're also mindful of her relationships. Other than doing cognitive behavioural therapy, I also do systemic family therapy. So we did a couple of sessions of couple therapy to help her be mindful of her relationships, because for her, her partner felt quite helpless. He didn't really know what to do. He didn't know how to help. So much of the sessions were communicating for the both of them to talk about their concerns openly. And also with her, it was to explain to her children what was going on. They were adult children, in terms of how everybody can help her to cope with her difficulty. And importantly, to increase communication within the family and between the partner, within the couple, helped to break down barriers and also to increase communication, which reduces stigma. By her sharing her experiences with other people, she became more confident. This increased her self-esteem and her confidence that she wasn't alone and that she had lots of strategies to help her. And finally, throughout the whole process, we were mindful of the biopsychosocial model, which is the link between the biology, psychology, and the social aspects. So we looked at the biological aspects in terms of help from dermatology. The psychological aspects was within therapy, and then the social aspects was with the couple therapy, where we looked at all the social interactions and how we could help her overall. Thank you very much.